Thanks for downloading a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned for your 3CR podcast.
Hello and welcome to Lost in Science for another week. We are very fast running out of weeks in this year, so you better get all the science you can fit into your brain for at least, well, the next 30 minutes. My name is Claire, and with me this week I have Lyndon and I have Chris. Hello.
Hello, Claire. How are you?
Oh, I'm so good. Chris, are you?
Yes, I am. I'm here. I'm good too, yeah. Fighting fit and ready to science.
Hey, look, we are all holding on until the end of the year. You know, whatever you do to celebrate the end of a calendar year, it's all happening right now, isn't it? Chris!
Yeah?
What do you have for this episode of Lost in Science this week?
Well, thank you, Claire. Yeah, we are closing into the end of the year. So, you know, you want the big science discoveries to slow down a bit. But you never quite know what's going to be a big science discovery and what's going to turn up. This one caught my eye. I'm quite excited about it, but I don't know. We'll see how big it actually is. It could just be someone's opinion on something. But it was essentially an announcement of a new early human hominin species.
Ooh.
Based on fossils found in China primarily, or East Asia, but yeah, mostly China. Yeah, and so I had a bit of a look at that, and it's kind of the complicated story that is human evolution and the controversies of trying to name species and work out what happened when it was hundreds of thousands of years ago. And yeah, it's going to take a while to figure out, I imagine. And Claire, have you got something interesting for us?
Well, Chris, I am very excited to be bringing a story back from about 6 months ago about orangutans using plants to make their own medicine and treating their own wounds. So, yeah, we're talking about a different type of ape, a hominid, if you will, this week, bringing back from the archives. So, yeah.
Oh, cannot wait for that. That sounds awesome.
I know. It's going to be great to revisit. Without any further ado, let's get on with the show.
Okay, yes, you're listening to Lost in Science, and I am talking about a new species of early human.
Hang on. For those listening, can I just say that you just put new in inverted commas, in air quotes?
That's true. Well, I mean, when I say a new species, obviously, you know, something from ancient can't be new.
Right.
You know, and also these aren't new fossils we're talking about. It's just a new classification of the bodies.
Right. Okay.
So, yeah. So the new is kind of, don't think that there's suddenly a new species of human has appeared on Earth, because they're long gone and the bones have been around a long time anyway. So on top of it, I should say, yeah, early humans, these are hominins, not hominids. Don't get those, your hominins and your hominids confused.
Not the homonyms? Isn't that the
homonym is a thing that sounds the same. A hominin.
Oh, okay.
Oh, my. Or a hominin. Okay.
So hominin is not a homonym for a hominid.
My brain is starting to collapse with all this, but yeah, no, it's not. So a hominin is you're basically your human family, your Homo genus, and then all your, you know, Australopithecus and all those kind of related things like that. Hominids is a bit bigger, includes the great apes like your gorillas and chimpanzees and stuff. So yeah, don't get your hominins and your hominids confused. This is a new classification of some existing fossils. It's basically trying to make sense of the story of human evolution. It is actually fairly new, this species, and not everyone agrees with it, of course. There's a lot of different ideas out there because, human evolution is complicated. I mean, imagine all evolution and, reconstructing the evolution of any species is going to be complicated. But I suppose, for humans, it's more noticeable because I think we care about it more. This is one of the big kind of stories about where we came from as a species. It's also one of the reasons why you get such widely differing opinions and arguments. People get very passionate about this stuff because, I think we've got a stake in it, really, is the impression I get. So that's another disclaimer here, that there will be people who disagree with this research and they'll have strong opinions about why it's wrong, but not my problem. I'm not one of the researchers. Anyway, so this involves some fossils that have been found in East Asia. Basically they have found a whole big, over the decades, they found a huge variety of different hominin fossils. And trying to work out what species they represent has been quite complicated. And there have been various species proposed in the past. And some of them are kind of more obvious than others. So you might be familiar with the hobbit, Homo floresiensis.
I visited the hobbit's cave.
Yes, that's right.
Flores.
Yeah.
It's called the hobbit because they're quite small in stature, right?
That's right. Yeah. And there's still, as far as I understand, there's even some disagreement about the hobbits, whether they are actually a different species. There's some people who claimed that they were diminutive Homo sapiens because they were believed to have lived quite late quite recent in our, in our time. But even then, the dates are disputed as well. I said it's complicated and there are a lot of arguments. It's hard to say anything definite. But there's a lot of different, a lot of different species. So this is where we try to make sense of it all. Now, the generally agreed picture of human evolution, you may have heard of, it's called the out of Africa theory. We're not talking about the classic 1985 movie with Meryl Streep and Robert Redford. But this is the idea that humans, both ancient and modern, really, evolved in Africa and from there spread across the world in successive migrations, I suppose. You had one of the earliest would have been Homo erectus, you probably heard of. It spread, I think, largely towards the east of the Eurasian landmass. The other most famous one was Homo neanderthalensis. Neanderthals, you probably heard of, found mostly in Europe. And then, of course, there was the Homo sapiens. There's another idea that is called, that there's sort of a multiple origins of humans, is the idea that humans kind of, different groups of Homo sapiens kind of arose in different areas. This was actually quite popular in China itself because they had these very old fossils. They had things like Homo erectus there, which is a more very primitive kind of human. This belief that perhaps humans evolved in China as well, or instead of in Africa. Generally though, the Africa theory is better supported by genetics, studying the DNA of humans across the world. You have much more variation in Africa itself than you have in the rest of the world. And you can kind of, using the change in DNA, you can trace the migrations essentially. That's basically how they mostly trying to figure out when the migrations happen. But even then, it's not so straightforward because the different species appear to have interbred as well. You've probably heard that a lot of people throughout the world have Neanderthal DNA in them. So they're 2 or 3% in a lot of populations. And that's found in basically all out of Africa populations, from indigenous people in Australia, across to, Europe, the Americas, that sort of thing. It's only in Africa, you get kind of these different populations that have arisen there. So there is, and this is believed to have also happened in Yeah, like across the whole sort of mostly the Eurasian landmass is where kind of all the mixing happened. And it's probably one of the reasons why you see such diversity in East Asia, in China, and why it's so hard to make sense out of it all. So what these researchers have done is they have been trying to make sense of it all. And they looked at those species though, and they tried to work out, can we group these? Can we say where there were some other definitive species, particularly in the kind of this later period? And there's a few that they've grouped together into this new species name they propose, which is Homo juluensis. And that means essentially big-headed humans, because they've looked at...
Sorry, big-headed humans?
Yeah, so they found these fossils that, they grouped together these fossils with skull fragments. It's mostly fragments you're dealing with here, that indicate very large skulls. Larger even than most modern humans, some of the specimens I've got. And we're talking about fossils from different sites as well, ranging over, 100,000 years or so. And so they said, this is a species, we'll group these together, I call these Homo juluensis. And except that's their theory, but they, other people believe that some of these ones aren't distinct enough from, say, Neanderthals to be a different species, but that's their proposal, that this is a kind of a more unique Asian species, yes.
So what's the feedback been so far? How has this new research been received? It sounds like, this is quite a contentious issue. I haven't seen this news splashed all across the papers. Does that mean the other researchers across the world studying this are, squashing it down, or there's been a lot of pushback against this new idea?
Honestly, I haven't found a lot of pushback. I think it is just largely because there are different theories. There are a lot of different ideas proposed. And so this has just been taken as just another idea. I mean, it's gotten some media attention because they have put out a cool name, Big Head People. And that's gotten people's attention. But yeah, like I said, there are other competing theories. Like the Neanderthals are very well known in Europe, as you'd be aware. And they were there for a very long time. They're not like there's not a single one type of Neanderthal. There's a big variation in them as well. But people generally don't divide them into other species. So there is a question about, how you decide what makes a species and what isn't a species.
It just all comes down to taxonomy, doesn't it?
It does. But there is another twist in this, is that one of the things they're trying to do with this new designation is trying to capture the other mysterious ancestors, the Denisovans. Have you heard of the Denisovans?
I have heard of the Denisovans.
Yeah. I have not.
So yeah, also from Asia, China?
Siberia, they were identified. Basically, there was a cave in Siberia called the Denisova cave, and they found some small bone fragments, not enough to really know what you're looking at, what it looked like, but they were able to extract some DNA. And using that DNA, they found that they were distinct from the Neanderthals, but there's also some Denisovan DNA in modern humans as well. So, which implies that they were also covering a lot of the same area and interbreeding with the different populations. In fact, they've since found a couple more samples where they'd be able to do some genetic analysis, and there's at least one individual seemed to be a cross between a Denisovan and a Neanderthal. But we haven't gotten much in the way of the distance, and no one knows anything about them. And so what these researchers are proposing with the Homo juluensis is that perhaps these fossils, otherwise kind of unassigned fossils in China, may in fact be the same species as Denisovans, or very closely related to the Denisovans. They're trying to explain the Denisovans, I suppose, if you will. They haven't got any DNA that as far as I understand, that they can compare to the Denisovan samples. They're trying to establish who the Denisovans are. Like I said, there's very little remnants of the Denisovans. We don't have any kind of much idea of their culture. We don't have enough fossils that they've got to give them a scientific name. You can't give them basically a species name, but you don't have a type specimen. You can say, this is what they look like. All we've got is like a bit of DNA, essentially. So yeah, the race is on, I suppose, to claim who can say who the Denisovans were and what they looked like. That's one of these attempts.
So would the next step be to try and get some DNA from the big-headed people? Do you think that's something that could be possible, or are those fossils a bit too old?
Yeah, look, there's a lot of fossils there. I reckon the odds are fairly good they'll be able to find some DNA from somewhere, one of these fossil sites. There are several fossil sites that they're examining. But look, it is really, it's really unknown, you know, what they will find at this point. You know, there are other individuals in that area that are distinct enough from these big-headed people. There's, the Homo longi, known as the dragon man, from a different part of China that I think is a bit older as well. There's also this one fossil that in their kind of big plan of how everything fits together, they can't identify it anywhere. So, there's a lot of things you fill. But you're right. I think getting some DNA will be the way to fill in some of these gaps. And particularly as we're relying on that so much now to establish the human family tree, I think that's going to be the way to go and work out how everyone's related. But if they are Denisovans, then it's possible we are all related to them. We all have some kind of legacy in these big-headed people. And maybe something to ponder about is, as you look in the mirror and try on your hats or your headphones or something like that.
Congratulations on your discovery, which may well prove to be among the most significant in the history of science.
I cannot accept half-baked theories that sell newspapers. I'm a scientist.
Who are you? Who are so wise in the ways of science?
A most distinguished scientist whose name we know, even in the wild of Transylvania.
Across Australia on the Community Radio Network, you are listening to Lost in Science.
This week on the show, we're swinging into the treetops and we're joining some of our closest relatives in the animal kingdom, the orangutan, because these magnificent apes, they've just been documented displaying an incredible new gill, I guess you would call it. They've been observed using medicinal plants to treat their wounds. Actually, I should probably clarify that. One orangutan has been observed applying a medicinal plant onto his wound.
Okay, are we going to need some more details? But orangutans known to use other tools and that sort of thing. Is this completely beyond their abilities? What are we talking here?
Well, this has never been documented before.
Okay.
In any of the great apes to this extent. But as I'll talk about a little bit later, primates and great apes do medicate in certain ways, self-medicate in certain ways. But this is a really new and sophisticated way of doing it. You know where orangutans live. I mentioned one of the places in the introduction, Sumatra.
Yeah, a Sumatra place, but I also know them as Borneo. Is that
Very good. So they're the largest tree-dwelling mammals, and they spend most of their time swinging from branch to branch. As you know, the males and the females, they look quite different. With the male orangutans, when they reach maturity, developing these beautiful, fleshy, melon-looking flanges on each side of their face. I think I did a story about that a few years back. But I have to say, I'm not just mentioning it because I like talking about the fleshy flange. It's quite important to the story because this story begins with a male Sumatran orangutan whose name is Ruckus, getting a sore on his face. So, yes, Ruckus, R-A-K-U-S,
okay.
That's the orangutan's name, found himself in an area without a dominant male. So naturally there was a bit of back and forth, a bit of argy-bargy with some of the other males. And after this argy-bargy, Ruckus ended up with a gash on his flanged face, big old gash, and obviously wasn't very happy with this turn of events. He waited a couple of days and then decided to take matters into his own hands, quite literally. And he sought out a plant and found it. It's the Fibroria tinctoria, and it's also known as the Acar Kuning in Bahasa. So Ruckus chews the leaves into a frothy pulp. So finds it, chews the leaves, and then takes the chewed liquid, so just the liquid, and is documented in spreading this liquid all over the wound, the fleshy wound on his flange. And then, in addition to this, he then gets the mushy, chewed up leaf part. So not the liquid, but the, like, you know, the fibrous, cellulosey, leafy bit, and then applies it, sort of like a pasty poultice type thing, onto his face. Like a dressing, I guess you would call it. Yeah, directly onto the affected area. Now, it just so happens that when he did this, there was a team of researchers who were watching, and it was led by Dr. Isabel Lauma, a Danish researcher, and her team, and they've just published the results of this in Scientific Reports. It's called Active Self-Treatment of a Facial Wound with a Biologically Active Plant by Male Sumatran Orangutan.
Wow. You know. So hang on. So, okay, you say biologically active plant. So is this plant known to have beneficial properties? Like, do the humans in the area use this plant as well?
It isn't just any old jungle shrub. It is a plant of significant and known pharmaceutical quality. So it's found in tropical forests in Southeast Asia, and it's known for having analgesic properties, fever-reducing properties, diuretic effects. It's used in traditional medicine to treat various diseases, including dysentery, diabetes, and also malaria. And previous analysis of the plant show chemical compounds of, you know, these words that are incredibly difficult to say, to certain types of alkaloids, blah, blah, blah. But yeah, pretty much antibacterial, anti-inflammatory, antifungal, antioxidant, all the things that you would want if you had a large gaping wound on your flange.
Right.
So, yeah, Rackus, he was onto something and you know, put this tincture on his face and it worked. A couple of days later, you know, don't want to sound like, you know, someone on telly trying to sell you a product, but 3 days later, Rackus had no wound on his face at all. You will not believe it, Chris.
I mean, it's a sample size of one orangutan. So from a medical point of view, I'm still, you know, going to be a little cautious to buy your jungle.
What do you
shrub.
Mean? You're not going to go and get this miracle plant and smear it on yourself next time you've got an open wound? Ah, look, come on, Chris.
If my flange gets into it, totally. But this is pretty remarkable, though, because like when humans use these kind of things, you know, often with traditional medicine, you know, people will be using various plants and things, and it's lore. It's like passed down this knowledge in the culture. So does this suggest, I mean, what I'm saying is that Rackus would have figured this out himself, or this is like a cultural thing that the orangutans know about this plant?
Well, that's a very good question. And as you said before, it's N equals one. We've only got one orangutan, and they haven't established a good family history with this orangutan to understand maybe where it's come from, where it's grown up. You know, what sort of cultural knowledge has been passed down, if any at all, or maybe this is just a total innovation that Rackus has come up with himself.
Right.
So yeah, it's very much like a, but obviously he's doing it on purpose because.
Yeah, he went to quite lengths to do it.
He went to lengths. It didn't just fall onto his face.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And yeah, it the whole thing has got me questioning. I'm like, are there any other instances of animals sort of self-medicating and healing themselves? And researchers, there's a bit of a hierarchy when it comes to sort of self-medication. So when it comes to animals, so there's your basic behaviors such as avoiding contaminated food or not eating when feeling unwell, and then there's more complex instances of self-medication, maybe eating foods that are proactively to keep you healthy or that can retroactively address an illness.
Dogs eating grass.
Dogs and cats eating grass. Yeah. Jane Goodall described chimps eating leaves and bitter pith, chewing bitter pith, and that was demonstrated to have therapeutic antiparasitic functions. So that they're sort of some of the self-medication that sort of research and understanding that we have of animals. But rhaccus's behavior, it's very much a rarity in the animal kingdom. So an animal actually applying a plant to its body or its nest to benefit its health, and then actually seeing an animal treat itself with a plant that's known to have medicinal qualities is even more rare. So it's the first, as I said before, it's the first time that this has ever happened. You know, we don't know the intentionality of the behavior. They've been watching these orangutans in this part of Sumatra for a really long time, but they haven't seen anything like this before. So they're thinking, oh, well, maybe this is a new innovation. But then again, you know, they're not out there watching them 24/7. So yeah. Who knows?
And I guess if humans use it, it's potentially possible that they pick it up from watching humans as well.
Could be. Yeah. I don't know how close the human population is to this orangutan population.
Yeah.
Because it is quite a large reserve.
Sitting right next to a human. Yeah.
Peering through the windows.
What are they doing in the village with that plant? Exactly. Oh, I'm going to remember that.
Exactly.
Next time I've got something on my flange.
The other interesting thing is this plant is also not a common part of the orangutan diet. So
that's the other thing I was wondering. That, yeah.
The fact that rhaccus even went to it is remarkable, let alone, you know, chewing it up, turning it into a poultice, applying it to his face, all the rest of it. So obviously we've got a lot more to learn about these incredible creatures, and there's more innovation that's happening out in the world than just in the human arena. A profound reminder that ingenuity thrives throughout the animal kingdom. And that's all we have this week on another episode of Lost in Science. Thank you so much for joining us. Lost in Science is recorded on the lands of the Kulin Nations and the lands of the Jiringunj people, and is broadcast around Australia on the Community Radio Network with the kind support of the Community Broadcasting Foundation. If you would like to get in touch with us, we would love to hear from you. You can find us at lostinsci@gmail.com. You can find us on Facebook, where we are Lost in Science on 3CR. You can find us on all the best podcast places. Or you can tune in again next week, wherever you listen to Catriona, Claire, Chris and Stu get Lost in Science.
Thanks for listening to a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online.